Hello, John Dennis here on Friday the 23rd of January. Today, Guantanamo Bay will be shut within 1 year on the order of President Barack Obama.
Guantanamo will be closed no later than 1 year from now.
In Britain, a 3% fall in the overall level of crime, but there have been more robberies at knife point. And thanks in part to the economic downturn, more burglaries.
Perhaps an indicator of what's on their mind in Whitehall is the Home Secretary's response to these figures, which was to announce that she's going to hold a burglary summit in the next 2 weeks.
And Germans are being urged to cut down on their bratwurst and schnitzels.
They've basically issued quite a strong advisory telling people that they should return to pre-war habits and basically eat meat only on special occasions.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's Sandy Waugh with today's news headlines and a look at the papers.
The recession in Britain is expected to be confirmed today. In figures announced this morning, our gross domestic product is expected to have contracted for the second quarter in succession. The Bank of England said it expects the recession to continue for at least the next 6 months. One of Britain's most successful hedge funds has made £12 million betting on the fall in the share price of Barclays Bank. Lansdowne Partners has made its money by short selling, selling borrowed shares before the drop in price and then buying them back at the lower price. The company made similar millions from short-selling Northern Rock shares before it had to be nationalised. In the USA, President Obama has ordered the closure of the CIA's network of secret prisons around the world. He's banned torture and so-called rendition to those prisons and called for a report on new rules on how to deal with detainees. With his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, he also announced two new peace envoys. Former UN Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, who helped to negotiate the end of the Bosnian Civil War, will work on Afghanistan, and the man who brought about the Good Friday agreement in Northern Ireland, former Senator George Mitchell, will become envoy to the Middle East.
There is no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. Conflicts are created, conducted, and sustained by human beings. They can be ended by human beings. I saw it happen in Northern Ireland, although admittedly, it took a very long time. I believe deeply that with committed, persevering and patient diplomacy, it can happen in the Middle East.
George Mitchell, the new US envoy to the Middle East. In Africa, the rebel leader who led the recent fighting in Congo, Laurent Nkunda, has been arrested in Rwanda. He leads a Tutsi rebel force which has been threatening to bring down the government. He's reported to have resisted a joint military operation by Rwanda and Congo. It was believed that he'd gained much of his financial and military support from Rwanda. The National Audit Office says delays in dealing with asylum seekers to Britain are getting worse. It reports the number of cases which were not dealt with in the last quarter of 2008 doubled to nearly 9,000. The report also says fewer than 1 in 10 rejected asylum seekers are actually deported. The new US president still grabs a big share of our daily papers. The Guardian leads on the closure of what it calls the CIA ghost prisons. The Independent, writing before the announcement of envoy Richard Holbrooke, says Obama is ready to cut President Karzai of Afghanistan adrift. It reports that his political rivals have arrived for talks in Washington. The Financial Times goes for the economy and reports the new Treasury Secretary has attacked the Chinese while he's going through his congressional confirmation hearings. Tim Geithner accused China of manipulating its currency to keep it artificially low and so encourage its exports. Geithner said he'd take aggressive international moves to make Beijing play fairly. On the British economy, the Times tells us that the Commons Treasury Committee will report today that the Chancellor should declare the true cost of bailing out the banking system. It believes he should have to give full government figures every 3 months, like a company. The Guardian tells the story of the hedge fund that made millions out of betting on the fall in bank shares. And The Express says there are a 92% rise in home repossessions, families being evicted at a rate of 1 every 7 minutes. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
The first executive order that we are signing by the authority vested in me as president by the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America, in order to effect the appropriate disposition of individuals currently detained by the Department of Defense at Guantanamo, and promptly to close the detention facility at Guantanamo consistent with the national security and foreign policy interests of the United States and the interests of justice, I hereby order.
Barack Obama has signed an executive order ordering Guantanamo Bay military prison to be shut down within a year. The new American president also ordered the closure of CIA prisons around the world, and he halted the harsh interrogation of terrorism suspects. He hopes these moves will help to restore America's reputation abroad. Ewan McCaskill is in Washington. He says the big question is, what will happen to Guantanamo's inmates?
We don't know what will happen to the inmates, and that's something that will be the centre of discussions over the weeks and months ahead. I mean, the likeliest thing is that a lot of them, or the bulk of them, will be released and sent to neutral countries, not back to their own countries, because there's a danger that they would be imprisoned and possibly tortured or executed. So they'll go to maybe countries in Europe. But there's a sort of hardcore of maybe a 60 to 80 that could face trial, and they're likely to be taken to the US mainland. There's a lot of discussion about possibly, you know, one of the maximum security prisons in a place like Kansas. So the bulk of them will be released, and a chunk of them will be taken to the US mainland. Be a significant shift, because as soon as they arrive in the US mainland, they're subjected to normal American laws, habeas corpus, and the basic rights that American citizens enjoy.
President Obama has also imposed strict guidelines on the interrogation of terror suspects, including a ban on the use of waterboarding. An equally significant move, Ewan.
It is. I think the world's been waiting to hear this for a long time. It applies only to basically to the CIA. The Army, as far as we know, we're told that the Army has a field manual that bans torture and waterboarding, and they haven't used it. It was the CIA used waterboarding at Guantanamo, so that this ban is applies specifically to them. Now, I think they've long sort of since ceased using waterboarding anyway, because they realise it's sort of tainted evidence and it's made the chances of a fair trial almost non-existent. But it sends a huge signal to the rest of the world that this disgraceful episode in American history is over.
And meanwhile, Hillary Clinton has begun work as Secretary of State, and President Obama has told her that the restoration of America's image abroad is a top priority for her.
It was interesting when she gave her first speech at the State Department, where she was sort of welcomed by State Department officials. She didn't give any sort of clues as to what her policy might be on toward Israel, Palestine, or Iran, or anything else. But there was important messages there between the lines. She said that she wasn't the kind of person that would wake up in the morning worrying about the dangers of terrorism, although she said that was a very real threat. She woke up in the morning and thought about what she could do that was positive in the world. So that's a very big difference in philosophy from the Bush administration. The Bush administration was about frightening people and constantly warning about the security threat to the US. She's saying, yes, I'm worried about the security threat too, but I'm also determined that we should start to have sort of positive engagement in the world. And she tied US foreign policy to development. The State Department is responsible both for foreign policy, but also for the development budget. And you can see that she's going to try and get the two working in tandem.
Ewan McCaskill in Washington. And there's full coverage of Obama's third day as president today at guardian.co.uk/Obama. Also on The Guardian's website, Fred Pearce argues that the railways have had an easy ride on climate change at guardian.co.uk/environment. Louis de Bernier meets one of his heroes, a national treasure, the clarinetist Acker Bilk, or Mr. Acker Bilk as he used to want to be known, guardian.co.uk/music. And Jay Rayner, the Observer's food critic, seeks your tips for eating cheaply at guardian.co.uk/word of mouth. New figures show a 3% fall in the overall level of crime in England and Wales between July and September last year. But there was a sharp rise in the number of robberies involving knives, and the Home Secretary's convened a burglary summit after a rise in the number of home break-ins. Our Home Affairs editor is Alan Travis.
Well, they seem to show that the first signs of the impact of the economic recession are beginning to bite on the crime figures. The headline overall, the figures look quite good for the government. 3% down all crime by the police measure, and stable according to the more authoritative British Crime Survey. Even violent crime is further falls in violent crime on the police figures. But within that, there are one or two warning notes for ministers which are alarming them. There's a 4% rise in domestic burglary. You haven't seen any increases of significant kind in burglary since the mid-1990s. In actual fact, after the impact of the 91-92 recession was seen. And that's perhaps the most worrying indication for the government, because burglary is a big volume crime. Small changes and increases in burglary have an overall likely big impact on the overall crime rate. So if that's sustained, that could be very politically damaging. There's also violent crime, which is overall down. Robbery is down 3%, but within that category, there's a small rise. There's 18%, alarming sounding, 18% increase in street robberies committed at knife point last summer, which is why, perhaps explains why the government was so keen to get out the more reassuring figures about the results of their recent knife crime campaign in the 10 hotspots 2 weeks ago, for which they got censured by the government statistics watchdog for a premature disclosure. Perhaps an indicator of what's on their mind in Whitehall is the Home Secretary's response to these figures, which was to announce that she's going to hold a burglary summit in the next 2 weeks.
Yes, who's going to attend that?
Well, she wants to have the police there, obviously, but she also wants to see Neighbourhood Watch and, interestingly, do-it-yourself DIY stores as well. And looks as though at that summit she's going to announce the availability of a new Home Office fund to encourage hard-pressed families, perhaps unemployed families, who haven't got the best locks and bolts for their doors, which seems over the last decade to have been the best defence against an increase in burglary.
I mean, to what extent can the rise in the number of burglaries be ascribed to the economic downturn?
Well, it's not mechanical, but I think it's long been established now and accepted that the best anti-crime measure you can have is a job. And if unemployment is rising, starts to rise and accelerate, then there are going to be more people without jobs. That doesn't mean to say, of course, that the unemployed, if you're unemployed, you're going to go and thieve. But it does seem to be that burglary particularly is an opportunistic crime. And as unemployment rises and joblessness rises, then burglaries and other kinds of property crimes, it's called, tend to increase as well.
Alan Travis. £225,000 small investors in Norwich Union's Life and Pensions Property Fund have been told they can't withdraw their money for 6 months. Aviva, formerly Norwich Union, said the move would protect the long-term value of investments from the effects of the dramatic slump in the commercial property market. The deputy editor of Guardian Money, Philip Inman, explains.
Well, Norwich Union, like most of the insurance companies that run property funds, have got a very big problem. One of the problems is that the value of commercial property has plummeted over the last year. It was already plummeting the year before when the credit crunch started. And people want to withdraw their money when they see things falling. And the problem is you can't flog a commercial property like a shop or an office very quickly. And while they've been winding down the fund, the amount of withdrawals has been getting bigger and bigger. And now they've had to put a freeze on anyone taking out any more money while they go and sell some more buildings in order to give people their money back. And the reason they have to freeze it is because if they have a fire sale of properties, they do it overnight, then you sell it for a fraction of what it's worth, and actually investors do much worse.
It's a bit of a cheat though, isn't it? I mean, investors' money and they can't get to it.
Well, it seems like a bit of a cheat, doesn't it? But I think actually Norwich Union are doing people a favour, just like all the other insurers who've seen people panic when things go down. You know, if you're going to invest, if that's what you want to do, rather than save, you know, I mean, if you want to put it in a savings account, obviously it's totally safe with the bank, hopefully, if it hasn't gone bust. But obviously the government has said it's safe. But if you want to invest, you're taking risks, and you should really be advised that you should be investing for the long term. You should be not just panicking as soon as things go down. And in some ways, the property funds are doing people a favour by locking them in and saying, no, you cannot take a huge loss on your money just because you've been advised by somebody that you should get their money out. You should keep it there.
It's quite an interesting question, though, isn't it? I mean, where should investors invest?
Well, I think if you look across the last 10 years, unless you put your money in boring old national savings, every single asset has gone down. You know, you have to ask yourself, why did it go up in the first place? Well, there are lots of reasons. But I think one of the real problems is at the heart of the city, which is this selling culture, which means everybody in the city is paid to sell stuff. That means that they go to you and say, buy this, it's fantastic. When it doesn't look that great, they don't say stick with it. They say get out of it and buy something else. Why? Because that's the way they're paid. They're paid for transactions. And people are churned. They're churned in through commercial property. Don't get into that. Buy oil. Buy gold. No, don't buy gold. That's going down now. Go buy shares again. You know, and this churning doesn't do anyone any favours except for city traders. City traders and their Ferraris. That's the only people who benefit from this whole fiasco.
And has the bottom of the UK investment market now been reached?
No, I don't think so. I think we've got more pain to come on the economy, which means that foreign investors will be pulling out their money, which means that even if UK investors stick with it, the value of things is going to go down because there's more sellers than buyers. So we're going to see this for some time yet. And I think that if you're a UK investor, you just got to weather it. You know, it's not cash, it's your investments, it's your wealth. And you weren't really as wealthy as you thought you were in 2006. It was all a false market. You know, that your house was worth, you know, twice what it was 10 years before. I mean, it was a nonsense, really. And the same for commercial property and most of the other assets you can think of. And you're just going to have to hunker down and accept that you're not as valuable and wealthy as you used to be. And things, when they come back, will hopefully grow at a more steady pace. And we really won't have the boom and bust that Gordon Brown promised us.
Philip Inman. My name's John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, Zan Brooks on the Oscars.
Out of all of the films nominated for Best Picture, it's a middleweight list. It's not as good as last year where you had No Country for Old Men and There Will Be Blood.
But first, hundreds of illegal immigrants from Bangladesh and Burma are believed to have died after Thai soldiers left them to drift on rafts with little food and water. Indian Coast Guards rescued around 400 starved and dehydrated people in the Andaman Islands. About 200 were picked up by the Indonesian Navy. Ian McKinnon is in Bangkok for The Guardian.
Well, these people from Burma, they're a minority from Burma, basically came to Thailand. They're essentially economic migrants trying to get to Malaysia, but the shortest route is through Thailand. So they come to Thailand, but these people were either arrested on arrival in Thailand or more likely intercepted a little way off the coast by the Navy. And what happened was then that they were brought to an island off the coast of Thailand, not far south of the Burmese coastline as well. And it seems after a time being detained, they were put back on some boats or a barge. None of them had engines, and the Thai army seems to have towed them out to sea and set them adrift, basically, with very little food and water, just some rice and a little water, where many of them drifted for up to 15 days.
And do we know how many are said to have died after this?
It appears that there were about 1,000 people in a number of boats who were treated in this way. Some of them have made it to shore or been rescued either in the Andaman Islands, which is an Indian island, or they've made it to Indonesia, to Aceh. But 550 of these are still missing and really presumed dead.
What's the Thai government saying about this?
The Thai government has really found itself in a very difficult position. The army has said that they have not mistreated this minority group, and likewise the Prime Minister has said that there has been no ill treatment, but at the same time, they're saying that they will mount an investigation into what happened. So it's really unclear how they can say nobody was ill-treated and they will hold an investigation into what happened, because they don't really know what happened.
The Thai Prime Minister has pledged to take human rights seriously. What is the policy of the Thai government towards illegal immigrants?
Well, they find themselves in a very difficult position because in the north of the country, there are many Burmese come across the border. It's a very porous border, and there are estimated to be upwards of 2 million Burmese in Thailand alone. Many of them work in industries or jobs that Thais wouldn't want to do. So they're very important to the Thai economy. Likewise, there are Laotian migrants from neighbouring Laos and other countries as well, because Thailand is a relatively prosperous country. So Thailand finds itself in this very difficult, quite difficult position in that they need these people for their economy, but they don't want too many of them.
Ian McKinnon. Bratwurst, schnitzels. Germans eat more meat than almost any other European. They get about 39% of their overall calorie intake from meat. Italians get just 25%. But now Germany's Federal Environment Agency has urged Germans to eat less meat and help save the planet, as Kate Connolly reports from Berlin.
Well, they've basically issued quite a strong advisory telling people that they should return to pre-war habits and basically eat meat only on special occasions, and otherwise that they should be modelling their diet on that of Mediterranean lands, i.e., as we know, lots of olive oil and little meat. And this obviously comes as quite a shock for a country that very much loves its bratwurst and schnitzels, and where vegetarianism is still quite a dirty word.
I didn't really know that the German appetite for meat has only been a relatively recent phenomenon since the war.
Before and after the war, people only ate meat about once a week. Obviously, it was seen as quite a luxury. Maybe they boiled some bones and, you know, as probably fairly similar to habits in Britain. But then with the economic miracle that took place in the 50s, meat became a luxury. And now it's normal to eat meat more or less every day, pork being the favoured option.
What's been the reaction to this advice from the government?
Well, quite mixed. I mean, as you can expect, the vegetarian society, VEBU, they are delighted, saying that finally politicians have caught on to the idea that it's unsustainable, the amount of meat that we do eat. Just simply the environment, the impact on the environment is too great. On the other hand, we've got agricultural experts saying that this is completely unrealistic, and that with his remarks, Andreas Troger, who is the president of the Federal Environment Agency, he's basically issued they've said he's issued a boycott on German agricultural produce, and that he's also, it's a sort of nannying to Germans about what they should eat and what they shouldn't.
Kate Connolly.
Welcome to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Yes.
That's from the trailer to the British film Slumdog Millionaire. It's in the running for Best Movie at the Oscars. The Academy Award nominations were announced yesterday. Guardian film critic Zan Brooks says Slumdog Millionaire may be Britain's brightest hope at this year's ceremony, and it's not been a very good year for Britain.
No, it's got a lot worse just lately. We had a great year for the Brits, but that was at the Golden Globes earlier this month. The Oscars aren't shaping up quite the same way. You know, Sally Hawkins, who is in Mike Leigh's Happy Go Lucky, was really tipped for a Best Actress nomination. That didn't happen. Kristin Scott Thomas, likewise, didn't get a Best Actress nomination. Michael Sheen didn't get a Best Actor nomination. So really, it's kind of all down to Kate Winslet.
But even she was not nominated for Revolutionary
it's
Road.
It's quite weird, isn't it? You know, she's in both Revolutionary Road and The Reader. She was nominated, she won the Best Actress for Revolutionary Road at the Globes. But here, in the Oscars, she's nominated for Best Actress for The Reader. So it's this weird kind of, it's almost like the Academy is deliberately trying to do something different from the Globes to kind of, you know, draw a line in the sand that they're not following the Globes script.
Do you think Danny Boyle's in with a chance for the Best Director Oscar for Slumdog Millionaire?
I think he is, and I think that Slumdog Millionaire is the favourite for Best Picture. It's one of those things that it's a film that seems in tune with history in a way that maybe the other nominees aren't. You could make a case that this is the first kind of blockbuster of the globalised era. It's kind of world cinema with a Hollywood narrative. It's a film that's shot both in English and in Hindi. It doesn't have stars. It's also a kind of feel-good film. When you think that the last two Oscars, Best Picture Oscars, have gone to The Departed and No Country for Old Men, which are both incredibly bleak, violent, nasty films, maybe the Academy is going to be looking for something a bit different this year, and Slumdog Millionaire ticks all those boxes.
And what about the curious case of Benjamin Button? 13 Academy Awards nominations, a lot.
It's a lot, and it's actually the second most ever. Titanic and All About Eve both got 14, both of which actually went on to win the Best Picture. So these are good omens for Benjamin Button. I have to say, I think out of all of the films nominated for Best Picture, it's a middleweight list. It's not as good as last year where you had No Country for Old Men and There Will Be Blood. But I think out of all the nominations, I think that Benjamin Button is my personal favourite. It's a fascinating, inventive film. It's a bit exasperating at times. It's very whimsical. It's kind of Forrest Gump for kind of clever people, you know, with all that entails. So, but I did really like it. I would like to see Benjamin Button win. I don't think it will.
And a posthumous nomination for Heath Ledger.
Yeah, and again, this will be a kind of history-making thing if Heath Ledger wins. There's only been one actor who's won a posthumous Best Actor Oscar, and that was Peter Finch for Network back in 1977, I think. And Ledger is the favourite to win this award for The Dark Knight.
Any glaring omissions?
Glaring omissions, I guess Revolutionary Road is a glaring omission. People thought that was going to be there. I think maybe I've Loved You So Long is not there with the Kristen Scott Thomas film. I think in the Best Foreign Language Film category, everyone was assuming that Gomorrah would make the cut, and that hasn't happened, although Waltz with Bashir is a superb film and should take that.
Zan Brooks. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.